ex-offender's register wasn't around in 1995, but he's on it now. 3. Amy used to go to a church youth club. Obviously, we hauled everyone in that was involved with that group, a reverend and quite a few volunteers from the church. It came to nothing, but the investigations turned up some unspent convictions for one of the old boys, and he was booted out. There wasn't anything to tie him to Amy, plus he couldn't drive, and it's unlikely Amy was abducted on foot or more people would have seen her. She had a boyfriend, but he was cleared early on. They'd not even slept together, all very innocent. Doesn't look like there was anything to find along Amy's walk home. No witnesses once she left her friends in the road outside the school, and nothing in her room that offered any clues. Although the photos will exist somewhere, but I really can't look for them. There was a lot less CCTV back then, and no one reported a car acting suspiciously. Did you know they'd done a Crime Watch reenactment? Might be one to look into. The mum, Joanne, killed herself a year or so after Amy was abducted. The stepdad left the area and changed his name. He's now living in Devon and is known as Robert Bell. You cannot tell anyone where you got that from, though, seriously. I doubt he's particularly savvy. He changed his name himself. I didn't get that from police records. I got it online. So you may turn up his info on 192.com. Good luck. And please do look after yourself. Matt. As hard as it was not to reply and say everything, Alex sent Matt a friendly but brief thank you and tried to put the source of the information out of her mind. She knew that he was putting himself on the line just by talking to her about this stuff. No doubt out of pity, which stung. The paedophile neighbour was almost certainly a red herring. A church guy just sounded unfortunate. And it wasn't the stepdad. Alex had never been a roving reporter, never wanted to be. But there was something about this static victim chewed away at her, something that sat just outside of her eyeline at all times. She had wanted to find out what really happened out of journalistic curiosity. But now that Matt was involved in a whisper of a way, she wanted to nail it, to present him with proof that she still had something about her, besides the whiff of ethanol and ammonia. Alex carefully worded a letter to Robert Stevenson/Bell, asking him politely to put his side across and help her fill in some gaps for a sensitive feature on Amy. There was one Robert Bell with the right date of birth listed in Ufcombe, Devon. With no phone number, no email address, and none of the tools of the trade her crime reporting peers would employ, it seemed the only route to reach him. 2 days later, at 2:45 p.m., a man's voice spoke carefully and quietly into Alex's voicemail.
"This is a message for Alex Dale. My name is Bob. You sent me a letter about my daughter, Amy. I might be willing to answer some questions, but I'd like to talk to you first. I don't use the name Stevenson anymore, and I'd need to know that you wouldn't publish my name now. I mean, the name I have now. Can you call me back, please, on 07781-257-539? Thank you."
Bob spoke in an oddly formal voice that sounded rehearsed. Alex wondered how long it had been since he dealt with the press.
"Hello?"
Bob's voice was gruffer and less practiced than on his voicemail message. "Hello, it's Alex Dale here, returning your call."
"Thanks for calling me back."
A long pause.
"I got your letter. I don't want to talk about any of this, but I know what you journalists are like, and I don't want you turning up at my door."
Alex was taken aback. Writing her fluffy features and navel-gazing pieces, she tended to forget that to most people, journalist meant doorstepper. "Thank you, but I would never do that. I hope you don't think I'm trying to do anything disrespectful to Amy or your family." Bob murmured something. Alex took a deep breath and trudged on. "Mr. Stevenson, I'd really like the chance to interview you." She waited a second to gauge his reaction, but silence was the stern reply. Alex realized she'd used his old name. "I would really like to sensitively portray what happened in your life after Amy was found and get a better understanding of Amy's life in general. No reply. But she could hear breathing. She knew he was still there. I could transcribe our interview afterwards and send it over for you to look at, to make sure you were happy that I'd written everything accurately. Give you what's called copy approval. The deeper the silence Bob held, the more Alex was giving up to him. She could never be a tabloid hack. She'd be eaten alive.
All right, came the gruff voice, finally. That sounds all right.
They arranged to meet the following Monday, halfway between Tunbridge Wells and Uffcombe, just off the A303. Didn't want it hanging over him, he'd said. Bob didn't want to be seen talking to a strange woman near his home, in case his new wife saw. But he hadn't returned to Kent since Joe's funeral, and wasn't about to now. Alex sat in the arbitrarily chosen little chef, convinced she would be stood up. If she were Bob, would she turn up? Almost certainly not. She'd probably drive up and down the road outside trying to peer in. Or perhaps she'd sit in her car in the car park, heart jangling, hiding behind a magazine whenever the little chef door swung open. She wondered if that's what Bob was doing now. He was already late. It was 10:20 a.m., and Alex could feel the dry rot settling in her throat and creeping to the back of her mouth. She had emailed Matt after putting the phone down to Bob. She had kept Matt up to date in a breezy, neutral email that had taken nearly 3 hours to write and rewrite. He hadn't replied. While she waited, Alex repeatedly clicked the refresh symbol on her iPhone inbox, but the number of unread emails stayed the same. 0. She felt out of place. She was out of place. Her trusted moleskin notepad and cross pen at perfect right angles to the table, with her iPhone positioned equally anally next to them, her Ted Baker dress and Chloe handbag. She knew she stood out like a dismembered toe. The plastic coating on the chairs was peeling off. The table corners looked like they'd been chewed. Discarded nappies had been piled in the corner of the toilet cubicle that she'd used upon arrival. A doughy-faced young woman of around 19 was walking around with a warm pot of thin coffee, refilling cups and glaring at people. Behind Alex sat a foursome of pensioners, all thick middles, nylon t-shirts, and red raw hands. 3 middle-aged men in badly fitting suits sat alone on 3 different tables, all throwing back coffee, tapping away at old-fashioned mobile phones, and shuffling dog-eared bits of paper around. Alex wondered who would ever buy what they were selling. Bob was now 45 minutes late, and Alex had received no emails apart from unwanted newsletters and irrelevant press releases. She didn't want to harass Bob, but she wanted him to know she was waiting, and that she understood and would be patient. She sent a text message. Hi, Bob. It's Alex. Just to let you know, I'm at the Little Chef, so just get here when you can. Don't worry if you're caught in traffic. I'll wait. As she set her iPhone back down on the yellowing table, a short, dumpy man in overalls barreled through the doors. His greying dark hair had visible comb marks where he had used gel or pomade, and he had a speckled doormat moustache. After waiting unattended at the "Wait here to be seated" sign, he walked into the middle of the seating area, obviously looking for someone. Bob? Alex asked quietly, doing the half-stand, half-stoop standard to these situations. Bob span around. His overalls were tight around his buttocks, and his belly was like a block, swinging around slightly later than the rest of him. He half-smiled and walked towards Alex.
Alex, sorry I'm late.
He trailed off. Alex gestured for Bob to sit down and looked around for a waitress. The plump, pudding-faced girl with mousy hair was nowhere to be seen, but a friendly older woman with a blonde bouffant walked slowly over, smiling.
What can I get you, sir?
Bob smiled warmly.
Hello, yes. Can I have a pot of tea and some jubilee pancakes, please?
He looked awkward.
I've not had breakfast yet.
The waitress, Valerie by her name badge, turned to Alex.
Can I get you anything else?
Actually, Alex smiled, I'll have some Jubilee pancakes too. The room seemed brighter, more sunlit. Alex had finally recovered from the nappy-filled toilet. She'd stopped scowling long enough to remember how she'd loved stopping at Little Chefs on childhood journeys to stay with her mother's various boyfriends, and, rarely, to visit her father while his wife was away. She'd adored the Jubilee pancakes and the orange lollies by the till. As a seven-year-old, she hadn't even known what a calorie was. As Valerie left them to it, they both sighed a little, at nothing, as if perhaps they could make this meeting about pancakes and grey tea a nice little rest stop.
I'm really pleased you agreed to meet with me, Bob, Alex started. I want you to know that I'm not out to do a hatchet job. I've never written about crime or anything like it before. I mainly write about health, and that's how I came to see Amy.
In her hopeful letter to Bob, she had explained her chance encounter with Amy, but she wasn't sure if he had believed her. She wondered how many offers to tell his side to the tabloids he'd received in the immediate aftermath. Bob cleared his throat.
Do I have your word that you're not going to stitch me up or tell everyone where I am? He asked.
His voice still had its gruff edge, but he had shrunk a little smaller in his chair. You have my word. She tried to imagine how Bob would have fared in a police interview. Snarled up with grief over his stepdaughter, probably terrified about his wife's ability to cope, being accused of crimes he couldn't comprehend. Alex and Matt had never seen eye to eye on police matters. Fairly early on in his career, he'd stopped talking to her about his shifts, about the terror on interviewees' faces, about the casual decisions he made, or the acts he witnessed.
Bob, I have a recorder on my phone, and I'd like to use that because I'm not very fast at shorthand. Would you mind if I did?
Alex asked.
I suppose not. I'd rather you recorded it than wrote it down wrong. That's what's done for me in the past.
Drawing a deep breath, Alex pressed record.
Chapter 12. Jacob, 10th of September, 2010. Jacob frequently drove past the shop where he'd first met Fiona. It had changed from a printer's into a pet shop, but it still made him smile. Sometimes. As he drove past today, he tried to shake the memory of this morning. Tried to think of the Fiona he'd first met, and not the Fiona who demanded to know why he'd deleted the internet history on the computer in the home office. Jacob had just stood there, dumbfounded. He had thought he was being paranoid, deleting his Google Map searches and everything else.
It's a surprise, he said.
What surprise?
Well, I didn't want you to see what I'd looked at because I was ordering a present for you, he said.
She'd rolled her eyes and turned away quickly. You should have said you were looking at porn. I'd have believed you then. 6 years ago, he'd been rushing in to collect some business cards for his boss. Fiona had been manning the till in the print shop, although she told him several times within that first conversation that she was just covering. She was actually a designer, and she even had a desk. She designed the business cards and leaflets for local hairdressers and plumbers. Fiona had astonishing flame-red hair back then. That first day she was wearing a kind of floral patterned dress, a half-cardigan he didn't understand, and Converse trainers. He'd have guessed she was 18, but found out later she was 22. She'd passed him the business cards in a box with a flourish, and before he could stop himself, he said,
You remind me of someone.
Someone awesome and hot, she'd deadpanned without cracking a smile.
Yes, that's the one,
he'd smiled, and she'd laughed. Want to take me to lunch? She'd asked, without showing a shred of the anxiety she later admitted to hiding really well.
Right now?
He'd asked. Yeah, why not? I'm owed a break. He'd been running late as it was, but he didn't say no. That was the part of the story she loved to hear again and again. They had paninis and bottles of beer in the Wetherspoons pub near the shop. Nothing like that had ever happened to him before, or since. It was like a cheesy film, and he'd not stopped smiling for the rest of the day, partly in bewilderment. Fiona had listened to bands he'd never heard of, and would push CDs into his car stereo when he picked her up from work. Bands with complicated, ironic names that made him feel out of touch. "You're such an old man," she'd say, kissing him on the cheek. "How did a cool kid like you end up in a town like this?" he'd asked on their first evening date to the bowling alley, where teenagers were throwing chips at each other in the next lane. "Uni," she said, sipping beer from the bottle as she sat back down after toppling three pins. "I did my degree at Rochester and then moved here for my shitty job. Don't get me wrong, I'd hate to live here forever, but Tunbridge Wells is all right. It's quite arty, not that far from London. The rents are reasonable." "You're not as cool as you look," he told her. Laughing, she'd acted mock-offended. "No, I'm definitely not." She'd smiled and rested her head on his shoulder as she took another big gulp of Rolling Rock. She'd stopped acting quite so cool after that, too. The flame-red hair that he loved was replaced by auburn hair with highlights and lowlights and the other things he half listened to her talk about. She looked less like a teenager then, more sensible. He was disappointed and relieved. She moved into his one-bedroom flat, and they spent the weekends and evenings in bed. She made him laugh from his gut. Almost nothing was off the table, and they talked and laughed so late that he was often late for work, despite living 5 minutes' drive away. Fiona was late for work constantly because she hated her job intensely. She'd made a mistake, she said, doing a marketing degree. She'd applied because it was a sensible thing to do, not because she wanted to do it. She had wanted to do graphic design, be a proper designer, but her parents had talked her out of it. So she ended up doing an approximation of the job she wanted, and it seemed to cause her a lot of bitterness. "I wish I had an ambition or a dream or something," he told her one night as they quipped over cheap TV and drank even cheaper wine on the sofa. "I'm so jealous of you for knowing what you want to do." She'd laughed sadly. "I don't know," she said. "I think it's worse to know what you want and not be able to get it. I envy your crushing lack of ambition." "What should I want to be when I grow up?" he'd asked her, mostly joking. "You're fine as you are," she'd said, and kissed him for a long time. A few months later, when he'd walked in on her crying in the bath, he'd offered to lend her the money for a postgraduate graphic design course. "I've been saving money for years for no real reason. I'd like to use it for something that matters so much to someone that matters so much to me." She was speechless for several minutes. For the first time since he'd met her, she stopped talking. "I don't know when I'll be able to pay you back," she'd said eventually. "Then you'll have to stay with me for the long haul," he'd said, smiling. Jacob pulled into the car park near the old print shop with more force than he expected. He didn't have long before his next appointment, and he needed to buy a present for Fiona.
Chapter 13. Amy. 18th of July, 1995. A thick instant sweat coated her skin, and Amy became slowly aware of her own hair, wet and sharp, digging into her skin and eyes. A trivial discomfort compared to her broken ankle and smashed skull, but it was this scratching pain that made her the most desperate. She lay on the soil, unable to move, unable to talk her way out of this, sweat cooling in the dip of her back. The dusky scent of the trees filled her broken nose with a thick perfume. She considered trying to scream. She had tried and abandoned pleading with her eyes as the noise neared her again. There was no hope to be had. If he had wanted to help, he would have. No matter how many footsteps, she was alone. Her eyes fell upwards as the great murky bruise of blues and greys tumbled overhead. Deep grey clouds slid across the sky as two white-gloved hands gleamed in the sunlight. Slowly they crept onto her neck. She closed her eyes, waiting for the relief.
Chapter 14. Alex. 13th of September, 2010. Alex held Bob's gaze as long as she could bear, trying hard to think of this as just another interview. After checking the iPhone was recording properly, she looked into her lap at her notes. Thanks for agreeing to answer some questions, Bob. Bob leaned in towards her, distrustful of the technology.
It's okay. You know my reasons for talking, and I hope you'll respect them.
Alex nodded. Bob, I'd like to go back to the beginning and ask you a few questions about your first years as a family with Joe and Amy. Are you okay with that?
Yes. But you'll have to bear with me if I get a bit upset.
Of course I will. Alex swallowed. Could you tell me when you first met Joe? Bob smiled.
It was in the spring of 84, and I was an apprentice plumber at the time. Tony, the old boy I worked for, used to drink in a pub called The Castle, and I'd go in there with him lunchtimes and sometimes after work. Joe worked behind the bar, and we used to have a bit of banter with each other. She was a bit older than me, and I knew she had a little girl, but...
Bob ran a thick hand over his face. It's okay, there's really no rush. So, Joe was a little bit older than you? Bob cleared his throat, leaned in again.
Yeah, Joe was 22 when I met her. We had about 18 months between us, which doesn't sound like anything now, I'm an old codger, but at the time we used to joke about it.
Alex smiled. So, where was Amy when Joe was working? Bob paused, looking upwards briefly.
Joe was good friends with a neighbour at the time, a girl called Carol. Carol had a little boy who was a few months younger than Amy, so they'd take it in turns minding the kids so the other one could work. Things were different then. You left your kids with people. You trusted them. Joe couldn't have afforded to pay anyone to look after Amy.
Alex looked down at her notes. Did Amy's birth father have any contact with her?
No. No, he didn't. He'd never met her. He was a brute, a really nasty piece of work. Vicious and violent. When Joe found out she was expecting Amy, she upped and left him, moved to Edenbridge and started again. Just her and the baby. She told him she was pregnant, and he'd said he didn't want nothing to do with it, with her. And that was for the best.
Bob stared at the cars whipping past the window.
Anyway, I don't want to talk about that scumbag. It makes my blood run cold just thinking about him.
Okay, that's okay. So, when did you move in with Joe and Amy? Bob tilted his head and leaned in.
Looking back, it was quite quick, but it never seemed it at the time. We'd been going out for about 3 or 4 months before I met Amy.
It's okay. Take your time. It's okay. Alex found the sight of men crying difficult, and hoped to God Bob held it together, or she'd end up in tears too.
Joe didn't want her to meet anyone that wasn't for real, you know? She didn't want to disrupt Amy's life or get her attached to anyone. She was such a good mum.
Bob spluttered the words a little. Alex had to stop herself reaching across to hold his hand. Bob cleared his throat again.
What was I saying? Yeah, when I met Amy for the first time, I thought she was brilliant. She'd done me a picture and I read her a story, and me and Joe took her to the park down the road from their house. I was skinny as a rake back then, and I showed off walking on my hands. You probably can't imagine that now. We got on straight away, and I think that sealed it for Joe, really.
Alex smiled at the image. So you moved in?
Yeah, well, sort of. I started staying over. And after a few months, we decided we should make it permanent. I moved in with them, and we all lived in the house that Joe rented. I was doing a bit better by then because I was qualified. And after about a year, we'd scraped up a deposit to buy a little place. We wanted to do things right. And I got down on one knee, you know. And we got married on the Monday because it was cheaper than on the Saturday. Amy was the bridesmaid and Carol and her fella were the witnesses. We moved into Wallingham Road on the Wednesday. We never had a honeymoon, but Carol had Amy for the wedding night. Other than that, it was always the three of us. Always. Joe couldn't have any more kids, so Amy was everything to us.
Did Amy call you Dad?
Sometimes, yeah. That's one of the things the police kept asking me. I don't know why, but they kept on and on about it. At first she called me Bobby, because that's what Joe called me. Then when Amy was about 6 or 7, she started to notice that all her friends had dads or daddies, and she started to call me Dad in front of them. I never pushed for that. At home she still called me Bobby, and then Bob when she got older. She'd call me Dad when she knew she'd done something wrong, or she was...
Bob's voice broke.
Or when she was scared.
Alex lowered her voice, hoping to hold herself and Bob together. How did you get on as she got older? Bob leaned back in.
We always got on great. I know I did her nutting sometimes because I was on her about things, but deep down I think she knew it was because I cared. She was a bright girl, our Amy, and I didn't want her to piss it away like I did, if you pardon my French. She could be a bit of a daydreamer, and she did silly things sometimes, but she was a good girl. She had a nice boyfriend, and I know she and Joe had the talk about all of that, but we didn't have to go on at her much.
Bob's mouth smiled, but his eyes drooped.
We were always laughing, too. Right from when she was small, she'd always have us in stitches. I'd take her out in the van with me when she was little, let her do the gears and all that. Have a little chat. She always cracked me up. They were special times.
I know this is really difficult, but you said that Amy was silly sometimes. What did you mean?
Oh, no. I don't want you getting the wrong idea. I just mean the stupid stuff that teenagers do. Walking home in the dark, a bit of drinking. Nothing worse than what I done. She and her friend Jenny cobbled this plan together once. Jenny said she was staying at ours. Amy said she was staying at Jenny's. And the pair of them got a train to Redhill and went to a disco there. Well, the reason I know this is because we got a call from Amy about midnight. They'd read the timetable wrong, missed their last train and had nowhere to stay. It was bloody freezing, and she was crying and she asked us to pick them up, which we did, obviously. We was cross with her, don't get me wrong, but I was so glad that she phoned, because a lot of girls wouldn't have. Amy could always be honest with us.
She sounds a lot like me and my friends, Alex lied. I know this is really hard, but I'd love to hear more about Joe. All I know is what I've read in the newspaper clippings and what I saw on television at the time.
Joe was a diamond. I loved her to bits. She was a brilliant mum and a brilliant wife. We didn't have much, but she loved our house and she was proud of everything we did have. And she loved that girl to death. She'd talk about how Amy would do all the things she'd never done. She'd go to college, university even. She'd have a career. She had high hopes for Amy. We both did. But more than anything, we wanted her to be happy.
Where was Joe when Amy went missing?
She was at work. She worked in a ladies' clothes shop in town. She got back at tea time and Amy wasn't there. I got back from a job not long after and Joe was already worried.
When did you realise she was missing and not just running late?
It got to about 7 and that just wasn't like her. She knew not to miss dinner.
Bob gulped his tea.
We knew something was wrong. We just knew. There's nothing like it. It's like this icy cold feeling in your belly. Anyway, I started driving around, knocking on friends' doors that I remembered, driving to school and back, not really knowing where to go. Jo rang all the mums she could think of, got a boyfriend's number and called over and over until someone answered. I think she was hopeful that whole time, you know, thinking they must be together because no one was there either. Then someone answered and told her they were having some kind of celebration meal and Amy wasn't invited.
When did you decide to call the police?
It was when I got back from driving around. It was getting dark, probably about 9 o'clock by then. They told us to check her clothes and look for a note to say she'd run away. We knew she hadn't run away. Next day, they came over.
Did you sleep at all that night?
Not a wink. I don't think anyone can understand what it's like for a child to go missing.
Did you continue living with Joe after Amy was found?
If you can call it that. I don't think Joe really carried on living after she was told Amy was brain dead. That's what we were told and all. As for me and Joe, well, I loved her with all my heart. But when the police took me away, the look in her eyes, I don't think any marriage can survive that. What made her think I'd done?
Bob stared out of the window and rubbed his eyes. A young woman was trying to feed her toddler into its booster seat in the back of her car, little legs rigid in protest.
When I finally left, Jo barely noticed. The papers said I was hiding, but I wasn't running away from them. I pleaded with her not to do anything stupid, but I don't know if she even heard me. And then a year after Amy was found, Jo couldn't take it anymore. There was no one there to stop her, and she took her own life.
Alex stopped the recording and held Bob's hand, trying to ignore the depth of her thirst.
Chapter 15. Jacob, 12th of September, 2010. Jacob pressed hard on the accelerator and slipped through the junction just as the amber light gave way to red. Fiona took a sharp breath.
What's up with you today?
Jacob didn't answer. He locked his jaw and squinted at the road.
Jay? Sorry, what?
He flicked his eyes at her for a split second before turning his frown back to the road.
Jay, what's wrong with you? Are you even listening to me?
I'm fine. Why?
He tried to smooth his expression out.
You're not fine,
she said quietly, looking dead ahead.
You're all over the place. I wish you'd tell me what's up.
You're worrying about nothing. Just relax.
Swinging the car into Royal Avenue was always difficult. He wished his parents had left Edenbridge, wished he didn't have to return to its streets. The town had wrapped around him like a duvet when he needed it the most, but leaving home for good was like ripping a plaster off, and the old wounds seeped every time he visited. He felt guilty that he frequently turned down invitations from his mum, who had always loved him so completely, so protectively. He was the only one left, in any real sense. As he parked on the crunchy, wide drive and slowly took the key out of the ignition, Jacob wondered if his younger brother, Tom, really would be here for the family lunch. He tried to imagine Tom perching on the edge of his chair, picking at his roast dinner, his black head with its scowling eyes nodding politely at the conversation and asking Fiona if she was having any twinges yet. The picture didn't work. Tom lived and worked in the Midlands. Within the family, it was referred to as Birmingham, but in reality, it was a West Midlands wasteland no one had heard of, burrowing into the backside of Walsall. They'd not visited. Jacob had often texted to offer to drop in when a planned trip took them along Tom's section of motorway. Tom would invariably make excuses or only receive the text once the trip was over. Each time, Jacob wondered whether Tom was as slow to reply to the teenagers he worked with. Then he would stop himself going down that line of thought. The last time any of them had seen Tom in the flesh was at Jacob and Fiona's wedding in Lancashire. Several of Tom's planned visits to Kent had fallen by the wayside since. Tom hadn't seemed comfortable in the pretty Lancastrian countryside that framed the wedding. He'd been clearly and inexplicably itching to get back to his adopted urban mess. Jacob loved visiting Lancashire. He loved the warmth and openness of Fiona's family, the work-to-live attitude, the pubs and the big, knotty open spaces. He loved the dry stone walls in the villages, and he especially loved how relaxed and happy he felt away from Tunbridge Wells. Until he thought of Amy. And then his chest would hurt, and his eyes would darken, and guilt would pull him back under. "Hello, darling, come in," said Sue, Jacob's mother, who was standing on the hall doormat wearing lambskin slippers and kissing Fiona on both cheeks. As soon as the heavy front door had swung open, Jacob picked up that distinctive smell of home. The fairy liquid and comfort fabric conditioner his mother had always used, the dark pink potpourri in the porcelain dish, the shaken vac on the carpet, the Pears soap in the downstairs loo, his mother's buttery cooking. "Hello, Mum," Jacob said, stooping down to kiss her cheek. Sue was 5'2". He, like both of his brothers, was more than a foot taller. "Is Tom here yet?" Sue looked away, her ears turning pink at the tops. She smiled awkwardly and explained that Tom wasn't coming after all. "It's because I'm here," thought Jacob. He couldn't pinpoint exactly when it had happened, because there were whole months, years maybe, when Jacob had been completely wrapped up in himself. But at some point, his younger brother, who had just always been there, whose loyalty he would never have questioned, had pulled clean away. Jacob remembered the afternoon Tom moved out with a wince. Although Jacob was 18 at the time, it had been 16-year-old Tom who left home first. Jacob barely noticed. His brother's spiky silhouette had appeared in Jacob's doorway, black-dyed hair drooping in front of his eyes. He'd had a big duffel bag over his shoulder, a couple of carrier bags in each hand. Tom had just stood there, waiting, possessions hanging off him. Jacob had looked up and said, "You off?" "Yeah," Tom had said. "Where you going?" "New Cross." "All right." It was only later that night when he walked into the kitchen to find his tear-stained mum eating cold cherry pie from the foil and splashing wine over baby photos that he realized Tom had gone for good. Jacob's memories of teenage Tom before that night were thin. The remains of toast crumbs in the morning, the sound of mopey music seeping from one bedroom to the next, a door slam. A shadow who had become a lone wolf and stalked away. Years later, Jacob had tried to build bridges. He had asked Tom by text message to be his best man, had insisted upon it. To his surprise, Tom had agreed, the only condition being that he didn't have to do a speech. The stag do was held in their hometown, a small night with several half-friends from work and university. Many pints into the night, the others drifted away. Jacob had staggered to his feet in the corner of a bar and asked his brother outright what the problem was. Did he blame Jacob for something?
"I don't blame you for anything," Tom had said, looking away. "I never hear from you, mate," Jacob had said, without expecting eye contact.
I don't know what I've done wrong.
You've not done anything wrong. Look at you. You've done everything the right way.
How do you know that?
Jacob had asked, louder than he'd intended.
You're not here to see how I'm doing anything.
He'd scuffed his shoe along the sticky floor, pushing himself away and pulling himself back on the brass rail around the bar.
I miss you.
Even steeped in beer, the words were awkward. Tom had paused for a long time.
You're better off without me,
he said, his words slurring like they were too big for his mouth. Defeated, Jacob had sloped out of the bar and to the kebab shop next door. After tramping up and down the main street in Edenbridge looking for a taxi without saying another word, the brothers had called their mother. Cradling their cold food, they had been driven to Royal Avenue in silence. That night, Jacob lay queasily in his childhood bedroom with the sounds of Tom's snoring rattling through the wall. He'd stared into the black, listening as Tom had risen to pee, heard the creaks and sighs as Tom had tried to get comfortable in the narrow bed again. Jacob had closed his eyes and tried to work out what he could say the next day to change things. In the end, he had said nothing.
It's so good to have you both here.
Sue clasped Jacob's hand over the table, surprising him. Fiona took a deep sip of her faux wine grape drink.
I wish we could see you more often, Sue said, the tip of her nose belying her Sunday dinner tipple.
We're just up the road, Fiona interrupted. You're always welcome to come over.
Thank you, darling.
Sue lifted her hand from her son's and placed it carefully back in her napkined lap.
Newlyweds need their space, though.
Oh, God, we're hardly newlyweds, Fiona said, her eyes struggling not to roll.
We've been together forever. We really don't need any more space.
Sue smiled in Fiona's direction for just a moment.
Well, perhaps I could pop round when you go on maternity leave, she said,
directing her question more to Jacob, who looked at his wife uneasily.
I'm sure she'd love that, wouldn't you, Fee? Come round any time, Sue.
You're welcome too, Dad, now you're retired,
Jacob added, taking a shallow sip of his blood-red wine.
Thank you very much, Jacob,
Graham answered, swirling his drink.
Thank you, Fiona.
The older man smiled at Jacob, and then for a little longer at Fiona, until she blinked first and looked down to carefully cut a roast potato.
I'm on the court every day at the moment,
Graham continued, looking back at his son.
Maybe you could join me for a game.
The court. When Jacob was a young boy, before he'd seen that the court was in reality a slab of ground with white-painted lines on it, he'd imagined it to be some grand building where only the brightest, fittest, and most manly were allowed to go. Simon had been allowed to go, the next in line to the court's throne. As the eldest, taking his position seriously, he had stood in the hallway, matching white socks with green trim, an upright, silent, knock-kneed version of his father with a miniature racket. Jacob had thought it might become his turn at some point, but his turn never came. He remembered Tom joining them a handful of times, but Jacob had judo by then and tried not to feel left out. He'd never mastered any ball sports. Of course Graham was on the court every day. Graham was a seesaw of health and overindulgence. He drank far too much whiskey and wine, but put in hours of intense tennis practice every day. He scooped chunks of gooey gourmet cheese onto yet bigger chunks of white bread for elevenses, but took 9 hours sleep a night, every night. Graham watched any sort of television show almost indiscriminately, but never had Jacob seen such an appetite for books of every kind. Russian fiction, crime thrillers, academic papers, manuals for cars he no longer owned and had never serviced himself. Jacob's mother said it came from all those years of commuting, consuming books to make the time pass. Today, of course, an executive's work would start the moment the train left the station. Emails on phones, laptops with dongles hanging out. But back then, Graham had an hour on the train and half an hour on the tube, each day, each way. But Jacob had no interest in any of those things. He didn't trust what he read, for one. And the thought of whacking a ball back and forth, especially against someone with a ruthless instinct and years of training, appealed like a bed of nails. Sure thing, Dad.
Chapter 16. Sue. 18th of July, 1995.
Girls. When Sue first married Graham, she'd imagined them having two little boys and two little girls, alternating like good dinner party table settings. The boys would be rosy-cheeked and handsome like their father, with bright grass stains on their knees. They'd tumble around, kicking a ball and getting up to mischief. The girls would wear matching pinafore dresses, with rosebud lips and bright blue eyes like little china dolls. While the boys would play football with Graham in the garden, Sue would sit and brush the girls' long hair, tying the tightest, neatest of plaits in matching ribbons. The girls that her sons had brought home were nothing like her girls would have been. As brash as boys, they flicked their hair around and seemed to have a staggering ability to use their bodies to get their own way, from a ridiculously young age. Her girls would have been different. Her girl would have been different. Every once in a while she felt a pang for the missing number four, the one that maybe, finally, would have been pink. But she couldn't complain. She had three strapping sons. Graham had been happy to stop at three anyway, more than happy. But since her first pregnancy, Sue had planned the second, third, and fourth. She loved carrying the babies, but Simon's pregnancy held a special magic. The only one bathed in ignorance and plans, nothing but hope. She'd expected the baby stuff to come easily once he arrived. She'd intended to have him sleeping through the night after a month, planned to snap back into her old clothes thanks to the Jane Fonda workout tapes that she would use while the baby napped. Potty training, she'd thought, would be done during the baby's second summer, and then the next baby would come along. And so she had planned to continue until there were four shiny-faced children, lined up in height order, like the Von Trapp kids. Boy, girl, boy, girl. From the agony of his breech birth to Simon's first reluctant day at school, it hadn't gone to plan. Sue had lived in her flannel jumpsuit until 6 o'clock, barely finding the time to apply makeup before Graham's car pulled into the drive. A baby with endless needs, Simon would absorb every shred of attention throughout the day and, at the same time, reject it outright. He wanted her eyes on him at all times, until Graham would appear in the doorway, and then Simon would frantically look for his gaze. All the while, Sue had crumbled into a world of loose clothing, while Graham's career was in an upswing. He remained handsome and controlled, while she was becoming hollow and scatty. It had taken 2 hours of the baby's tears, and sometimes Sue's, to vacuum a room, so she would put the task off again for weeks at a time. Graham never once complained at the state of the house, but he surveyed it with a slower gaze through narrowed eyes each night and started to catch the later train home, losing the haste of their early married years.
Eventually, Sue had resorted to carrying Simon under one arm as he suckled milk feverishly, pushing the Hoover with the other, lactic acid shooting up her shoulders. She'd relied on lean cuisine in the day and Vesta meals at night, and the rest of the time she had drunk tea by the bucket load and blown smoke out of the window and just stared at her angry, red-faced infant. It got easier with Jacob, easier still with Thomas, aside from the secret sadness at another blue bonnet. And when Thomas approached play school, talk, Sue's talk, turned hastily to the final piece in the puzzle, the one that would be a girl. Then, just as Graham appeared to soften toward the idea of having more children, the letter had arrived, written in calm text on cold paper. It spoke of abnormal changes and repeat smear tests. "Don't worry," Sue was told. "These things often correct themselves. The next smear could be completely clear." 6 months later, the calm letter was replaced by an urgent phone call from the surgery. From mild to severe changes. Cells were removed, and Sue walked home from the cottage hospital tenderly, gingerly, with Thomas clawing at her legs to be carried. After 2 years of repeated failed treatments, Sue made the decision one day while all the boys were in school. Sitting sore in the empty house after another painful outpatient operation. Graham later described it carefully as cutting our losses. The thought of him raising the boys alone was inconceivable. She had to forego future fertility. The stakes were too high. The preparation for the hysterectomy was as brutal as the operation. Fistfuls of pills every night, nightmares about being scooped out like a soft-boiled egg, crying fits behind closed doors, following women with baby girls around supermarkets, nothing in her basket. When she woke up after the surgery, head thick with morphine, she just felt empty. She'd stayed that way for a long while.
Chapter 17. Alex. 14th of September, 2010. Alex's heels raced to meet their mirrored counterparts, colliding with a loud click. The hospital had recently been the subject of a media-friendly deep clean, and everything shined as if polished beyond practical use. Alex had called several hours before, and with surprising ease, had been granted a little more time with Peter Haynes. She was already regretting the high heels, which pinched at her running blisters and slowed her walk. She knocked on the closed office door, the space inside sounding hollow and empty. After a couple of polite coughs, followed by some not-so-polite coughs and a sharper knock, the door finally opened. The doctor looked a mess. His hair seemed to be clambering over itself, and his eyes were wild. As he showed Alex to the worn leather chair again, she noticed that the room was immaculate.
"I'm sorry, Alex. I've been tearing my hair out trying to find something, but I don't know where anything is anymore."
Alex wondered if in this case, tearing my hair out was more than just a saying. To no one in particular, Peter Haynes muttered,
"Bloody cleaners."
He sat in the other leather chair, fidgeting like a child with worms. "Thanks so much for seeing me at such short notice, Peter."
"That's okay, but I really have squeezed you in, so I don't have long. How can I help?"
"I just have a couple of questions about Amy, then I promise I'll leave you in peace."
"All right, Alex. Shoot."
"Well, after Amy was found, some of the newspaper reports seemed to contradict each other. A few say there was no evidence of sexual assault, but others allude to recent sexual activity. That's only via unnamed sources, though, never official statements. More or less all of them say there were signs that she'd fought off her attacker. I just wondered if, medically, you know which story is correct."
The doctor held her gaze for a few moments, a
and then walked to a dull grey filing cabinet next to the brilliantly sparkling window. Muttering,